Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today's conference call will be hosted by Katie Murray, Chief Financial Officer. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tracy. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining me this morning. As we flagged at H1, with Q1 and Q3 really just being financial updates, I'm not being joined by Ross this morning. I'm going to give you a brief overview of our financial performance in Q3, and then I'm happy to take any questions you may have. The core retail and commercial bank continues to perform well, and our underlying performance remains solid in a tough operating environment. Our lending is up 3.2% year to date on an annualised basis. We are attracting new customers to the bank, and our costs are down. With a pre-tax operating profit of $2.7 billion for the first 9 months, in line with the same period last year, an attributable profit of $1.7 billion, up $0.4 billion from the same period last year. As expected, however, our Q3 numbers are significantly impacted by a PPR charge of £900 million, following greater than predicted complaint volumes in the lead up to the deadline. In addition, NatWest Markets had a disappointing quarter, generating an operating loss of $193 million, driven by challenging market conditions, principally affecting the rates income, and most significantly during August. The rates income was impacted due to elevated hedging costs caused by reduced liquidity and wider bid-offer spreads as the market experienced sustained curve flattening across European fixed income markets. These factors have contributed to a group operating loss of £8 million and an attributable loss of £315 million for the quarter at group level. Our cost journey remains on track, and we plan to achieve our £300 million target for full year 2019. So let me now take you into more detail on the results, starting with the P&L. Our total income across our retail and commercial business, excluding notable items, was 3% lower than Q3 2018, but was flat compared to Q2 2019. This was primarily driven by ongoing margin pressures and the contraction of the yield curve. Bank NIM of 1.97% was 5 basis points lower than Q2 2019. UKPB NIM decreased 7 basis points versus Q2, reflecting continued mortgage margin pressures as front book margins remained lower than back book. And, as mentioned in Q2, lower deposit margins as a result of the lower yield curve. As we talked about previously, our front book new to bank mortgage margins have been in the range of 80 to 100 basis points this year. In Q3, we have been writing new business at slightly above that range. We have also increased our volumes this quarter as a result of the operational and digital improvements we have made in the business. This means that we're adding mortgage income, which is offsetting the loss of margin. This clearly does not help NIM, but it is important for income, good for ROE, and reflects the strength of our personal business. Commercial banking NIM was down 7 basis points this quarter, as deposit income was impacted by the lower yield curve. However, our lending pricing margins have maintained in a competitive environment. RBSI and private continue to generate strong income flows for the group. NatWest Markets core income at £194 million was down £147 million or 44% versus Q3 2018, primarily driven by our exposure to the euro rates business, which had a volatile August. Additionally, in terms of income, one thing I wanted to remind you of is we continue to anticipate a circa $1.2 billion of FX recycling gains in Q4 upon the transfer of ownership of NatWest Markets NV to NatWest Markets PLC. This is, of course, subject to regulatory approval, and it's important to remember that it is both capital and TNAV neutral for group. Turning to costs, we reduced other expenses by a further £20 million in Q3, taking the year-to-date reduction to £193 million. As we have said, cost reduction will not be linear throughout the year, and we remain on track to achieve our £300 million target for full year 2019. There were £215 million of strategic costs in Q3, which included further property exits and ongoing technology transformation programme costs. Our litigation and conduct charge was £750 million for the quarter. This included £900 million of PPI provisions and a reimbursement of $200 million under an RMBS indemnification agreement. At Q2, I said our book was showing some signs of strain in terms of impairments. Our impairments in Q3 were £213 million. This includes a £55 million charge reflecting a more uncertain economic outlook, including the deterioration of growth forecasts, the ongoing volatility we have seen, and the slightly increased unemployment figures from an admittedly low level. We also had some IFRS 9 modelling adjustments in the quarter, which are reflecting some small deterioration in our assumptions. In commercial, we saw a small number of single name charges and in UKPB lower debt sale recoveries. In total, this makes up to 22 basis points of impairments year to date. We maintain our guidance of a normalised long-term loss ratio of 30 to 40 basis points. Overall, this takes us to a small operating Q3 loss and a year-to-date operating profit of £2.7 billion. Our fully diluted Q3 TNAV was 272 pence, down 17 pence on Q2, largely due to the interim and special dividend payments. Turning to loan growth, we have seen growth across all of the businesses in Q3, which is a good result. UKPB gross new mortgage lending, was £8.6 billion. In Q3, compared with £6.7 billion in Q2, with approval shares of 15%, market flow share of approximately 12%, and stock share of circa 10%. We are seeing good take-up of our new credit card product, where we had two consecutive quarters of growth in balances and customers. And additionally, our main current account acquisition continues to show the positive trend of Q2. We have attracted 190,000 gross new customers in Q3. Turning to commercial, we have grown our loans across the whole book by £0.1 billion in Q3. Lending growth across business banking, SME and mid-corporate and specialised businesses was £1.6 billion to date, or 4.1% on an annualised basis. We have also seen positive growth trends across Ulster, private and RBSI. Looking forward, we continue to target net lending growth across UKPB, Ulster, commercial and private banking at attractive returns. Q3 year-to-date annualised growth rate was 3.2%. This is above the upper end of our 2-3% net loan growth target, which we are clearly on track to achieve. And on deposits, we have grown these by £8.1 billion, or 2% in the quarter. So a large portion of this growth was a result of a number of larger corporate clients managing their funds. While we have grown our lending book, we have not changed our risk appetite. And as is our practice, we continue to actively monitor and manage our exposures. So overall, a strong story of growth across the business. On capital, we generated 35 basis points of capital from profits in Q3 prior to the PPI provision and RWA increases. We ended the quarter with a CET1 ratio of 15.7%, which reflects the PPI charge of 50 basis points. RWAs increased by £1 billion to £189.5 billion, principally reflecting an increase in NatWest Markets. NatWest Markets RWAs increased by £2.4 billion, primarily due to a need to hold higher capital on derivative assets, driven by market moves in Q3. We retain our full year 2019 RWA guidance of 185 to 190 billion. I thought given the week, it would be negligent not to comment on Brexit. We are focusing on controlling the controllables as the Brexit economic and political uncertainty continues. As far as RBS is concerned, our preparations are in place with our Amsterdam and Frankfurt offices totally operational. Above all, and most importantly, we continue to work closely with our customers as they work through their own Brexit preparations. So to summarise, we have continued to deliver strong net loan growth and delivering this in challenging times without compromising on underwriting standards. Costs are within our control and we remain committed to taking out $300 million this year, having taken out $193 million to date. On capital, we're in a very good place to generate and distribute sustainable returns. And finally, with Alison taking over as the new CEO next week, and as we approach the end of our 2020 journey, we look forward to updating you on our priorities in February. And with that, I'm very happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Katie. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for a moment to give everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for a moment to give everyone an opportunity to ask a question.
So, Tracy, I think we've got a few questions waiting, lining up. I'm just checking we're not having an issue with the line.
Thank you. Your first question comes from Jonathan
Pearce
of Numis. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, good morning. Three questions, actually. Two are just yes or no answers. I'll give you those now. Firstly, is the guidance for NatWest Markets revenues still the sort of 1.4, 1.5 billion that you've talked about before? The second yes or no question is on PPI. I just want to triple check that the number you've taken today includes everything that you see from the official receiver, because I couldn't see any comment on that in the release. The third question is on consensus, because at the interims you suggested you were pretty comfortable with a sort of 9.5% ROTE number for 2020. Consensus since then has come down to 8.4%. So maybe you could give us an update on your thinking for 2020 return on equity. Thanks very much.
Yes. Jonathan, happy to. And I think number one is probably slightly more complex than a simple yes or no in terms of NatWest Markets guidance. I think we're not looking to change the guidance at the moment, but clearly when you're sitting at 864 million of income year to date with a guidance of 1.4 to 1.6, we're not going to hit that guidance in this year. And I think I'll leave you to kind of take some views as to how that might evolve over Q4. In terms of PPI, it includes all foreseeable items that we see that we would need to pay out against that number. It's our best estimate of our ultimate liability. So I guess
okay. The
simple answer there would be yes. In terms of consensus, you know, as you will remember in August, we said that we believed we were unlikely to reach the 2020 target of 12% plus, and we purposely did not give a new target at the time. But I do recognise that when I was asked in Q&A, that I said I was not uncomfortable with the consensus ROTE of around 9.5%, and certainly at that time I was not. What I would say is since the 2nd of August, we have seen the yield curve and GDP expectations fall quite significantly. We have taken an MES charge today, recognising this increased volatility. I'm not going to give you an ROE target today, and I look forward to talking to you more about it in February, when I think it would be a more appropriate time for us to share that with you. So hopefully that clears up some of the confusion I've caused.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Raul Sinha of JP Morgan. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Maybe the first one, just to follow up on this consensus discussion, I'm not going to ask you for more color on the ROTE outlook, but I think in one of your recent fireside chats, you did say that you were hoping to do more cost reduction in the outer years. And when I look at consensus as it stands today, obviously consensus has got costs up in 2022 on 2020, and I guess where we're tracking towards. So would you reiterate that, or has even that changed?
I absolutely think that maintains the same. As we look at our organization, you know, we talk about $300 million a year of costs out. You know, and internally, what I talk about a lot is, look, guys, you need to think of that $300 million is a cost out year, a cost number out each and every year. In February, we'll give you what our cost target is for 2020, you know, and I kind of see something that needs to kind of roll through. You know, I probably wouldn't comment too much on cost targets in 2022, but certainly for me, the cost base has to be something that continues to come down, and I'm very confident that it will. You know, as we do more and more automation and digitization, this is a natural way of things is as we touch things less, it becomes a better cost-controlled environment. And so I would continue to see that being a major priority for us as a bank.
And I guess the lack of progress in Q3 on the cost target probably reflects the lumpiness of which you think.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I think on Q2, we were a bit ahead of everyone's consensus. And I would say, privately, accepting this isn't privately, I probably was a little bit surprised on the upside myself of the progress that we made up to Q2. Mm. The downside of that is, of course, then that Q3 is a little bit worse because you managed to do some things a bit quicker in Q2 than you had originally thought you would. I think the thing is to look at it rather than quarter by quarter, what's the narrative for the year? And, you know, we're very committed to the 300 million number for this year.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I mean, if I can also, Katie, come back to the mortgage income performance in this quarter. It seems to be the first quarter, you've actually managed to grow the mortgage income top line on a product basis if you look at the supplement. Is that something that is sustainable, you think, or is it too early to get carried away? Because obviously there is a balance sheet effect driving the NIR that is associated with that line. And for a long time, despite you being able to grow the balance sheet, the margin pressure in that business just meant that, you know, your top line was still shrinking. So should we think that, you know, given the fact that you've had a good outcome on the front book completion margin in Q3, you know, this is maybe a bit of a blip in terms of being able to grow that top line, or do you think that's a generally more sustainable performance going forward?
So, look, I think there's a couple of things that go on in that top line. You know, I think one of the things to always remember is the kind of the day count that you have. So we did benefit from an extra day in that quarter, so that adds a little bit onto that top line as well. But it doesn't change the message significantly. But I think for me, what I'm very pleased about is that the mortgage income that we're getting is offsetting what we're losing in terms of margins. Now, this is the first quarter we've done that. We know that we've written slightly above that 80 to 100 basis points. We know that in terms of applications today, we're still above it. I think it would be quick of me to call it out in terms of having done that in one quarter. It's definitely where we were working towards, that's something that's sustainable for every quarter going forward. But it's a very pleasing first sign. And I think let's all have a look at how it develops into the Q4 numbers and then into Q1. But I think what's really important is our ability to add volume is being able to offset that margin. I'm very happy to take it in this quarter, and we'll definitely be driving the business towards it.
Thank you. If I can have just one more quickly,
sure,
because it's so interesting. You've printed a 5.56% impairment charge on the cards business in this quarter. I don't know if I'm missing something there, but is that reflecting the change in the models you talked about, or is that sort of a more underlying assumption we should think about going forward?
So there'll be three different things going on, Roland. I know that you're familiar with IFRS 9 as well. So the challenge with IFRS 9 is as you grow your balances, you also start to print impairments from the minute you start to grow those balances. So you take a little bit of a loss there. You know, one of the areas, you know, cards we're going back into, we are watching very closely in terms of the PD. We kind of manage it around the fringes quite tightly. And so in terms of that, we've had a little bit of an increase in the PD, so we've done a little bit of adjusting of our underwriting in that space. And then also in cards, they'll have taken a little bit of the economic scenario overlay as well. We'll have hit that book also. I think also in cards, you're possibly a little bit, as you've got a smaller balance, so you get into a little bit of a percentage game of small numbers having sort of bigger impacts.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your questions.
Our next question comes from the line of Martin Leitgeb of Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Martin.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Katie. The first question on deposit, obviously you had a very strong performance in terms of deposits during the quarter, and I was just wondering to what extent you see repricing opportunities on certain pockets of deposits if the yield curve were to remain as flat as it currently is. So do you see some scope maybe on a fixed rate deposits to edge lower? Or within certain pockets of corporate deposits in order to adjust for some of the weakness. And the second question is with regards to NatWest Markets, and I'm just trying to understand what kind of your levers could be if the revenue weakness were to persist further in that division. So what would your levers be in terms of both cost and capital consumption for the group? I think there was a press article over the weekend which was hinting that the size of NatWest Markets could be reduced, and I was just wondering what kind of levels there could be for that, and obviously trying not to anticipate too much on what might come with an update on February or at some point next year. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. If I just deal with the deposits point first of all, I mean, I think, look, we haven't done any repricing. Traditionally, our stance has always been to only reprice as and when there is a rate movement. I think it's something, as you see what's happening with the yield curve, it's something you continue to look at, but we don't have any particular repricing going on at the moment. What I would note is that we're a little bit behind on the market share on deposits, which I think is because we're not actually actively trying to chase more deposits, given our strong funding position and liquidity position we've got at the moment. If I look at the funding rates, you know, it's 0.38 basis points within PB and 0.43 within commercial. So there's you know, in that there's some scope, but there's not obviously a long way that you can go with that. In terms of NatWest Markets, look, I think, you know, as we think of our targets, they're obviously all 2020 numbers. I think it is difficult at this point to sort of see where the year end may lie. And I think at this stage it would be overzealous to change the guidance after this one quarter, so we're not looking to do that. But certainly as we look around the group, and I think we will update you more across the whole group as we get to February. But I do think it's important to remember that NatWest Markets has been on a kind of a 3 or 4 year journey of change, and they're in year three of their 4 year journey. So I wouldn't go changing those numbers today. It's certainly been a disappointing quarter, and that will have an impact for our full year results as it rolls through.
But with regards to cost in NatWest Markets, would you see flexibility there if the weakness were to persist, that there could be some optionality to adjust, you know, to address some of the underperformance with the cost?
Yes, I mean, we're very much targeting a 1 billion cost-based target, so I think that they still are on their cost takeout journey. They, you know, if I look at Q3, it doesn't look a stronger picture. They did last year benefit a little bit from kind of right back, but look, we do obviously have some flexibility within our cost base, and we'll certainly be making sure that we focus and deliver the 300 million that we're going to take out this year. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of Fahid Kumar of Redburn. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Fahid.
Morning, Ethan. Thanks for taking the pressure. Questions. I have a couple of questions on NatWest Markets. On the revenues, obviously we've come through this a lot. I'm not looking for guidance, but am I right in thinking that none of the headcount reduction has happened to date? So all the headcount reduction that's coming will come in 2020, and I assume you're still assuming that there's no revenue pressure from that headcount reduction. And then the second question was, there's about $2.5 billion of risk-weighted asset inflation in NatWest Markets. There wasn't any obvious volatility in the third quarter, so I'm wondering why market RWA is inflated to that extent in the quarter. Was there something specific in your book that led to that? And the third question was on, I think it's following from Raoul's question, on the economic uncertainty charge of 50-odd million that you've taken. That was over and above IFRS 9. Was that just, you know, a further addition to that 100 million you took last year in terms of this Brexit uncertainty and economic uncertainty? Was there something else going on there? Thanks.
Thanks, Fahid. Let me try to take them through in a couple of places. In terms of the headcount point within NatWest Markets, when you look at the numbers clean, you sort of think to yourself, well, that's interesting. Their headcount looks like they've gone up, but they're talking about cost reduction. You know, what we've been doing throughout the last number of years is to really try to pull together all of NatWest Markets so they have as much control as possible of the entire end-to-end of their journey. We know that the fewer touch points and the fewer handoffs you have, is very much, it makes for the simplest, least control issue ridden process that you can create, and also naturally has a positive impact on costs. So that increase you've seen in headcount is actually transferring some people that would have sat historically in NatWest Bank into NatWest Market. So in terms of the reduction in the management of the front office teams, that's something that goes on, you know, actively as you're always trying to kind of manage your book. In terms of the 2.4 billion, I probably disagree with you a little bit around the volatility, and I think we've got a slide in the back of our packs which kind of shows what really has driven a lot of the volatility, and we saw significant volatility in August in terms of the euro rate fall when it fell very quickly in a few days within those euro rates, and that's really what's driven the result that we see And in terms of RWAs, the increase that we can see coming through there, you know, we've had some upwards revaluation of the assets and the derivatives, which are a bit more related to some of the legacy assets in relation to that volatility. A couple of backtesting exceptions in relating to the market shift because of some of the inflation expectations have put him over a more of a kind of in the weeds sort of technical point. You know, and also we're doing a good business with our commercial customers, particularly in the financing space, and that adds onto the RWAs as well. But it really was the movements and some of the volatility and the market risk on some of the derivatives that have caused that increase. And then lastly, just on IFRS 9, I think I wouldn't characterise the multiple economic scenario as in addition to IFRS 9. It's very much part of IFRS 9. You obviously have what we would call the day-to-day impairments, which move along with how much growth you've got in the book, what's happening on your PDs. And then we also have probabilities that we take of different economic scenarios. And that's very much what this MES is. So as you look at what happened from the end of June to the end of September, we really saw a decrease in growth. We saw increased volatility. We saw yield curves go down across, you know, the UK and across Euro. And that combined together is what's created this 55 million charge. It is similar to the charge that we took last year. The charge that we took last year is obviously it's in the models now, and it kind of evolves, and this is the kind of the next evolution of that number. Hopefully that answers your question.
Okay, that's great. Okay, can I just come to one quick follow-up on the headcount point? I know, I guess you'll tackle this a little bit in February, but are you expecting for the cost cuts to come in NatWest Markets, the net headcount now to start coming down in NatWest Markets?
So, I mean, as we always talk about headcount, and for our teams, as we talk to our teams before we talk to analysts, and to the press. But look, when I look at cost reduction, there's three places you can get it from. One is properties, and actually I think the property team have done a superb job in really managing our footprint in terms of our property space, particularly in the very expensive central London and resources. The next is technology. We've talked a lot about the improvements we've got there. And then the reality ultimately is, of course, it comes down to people. So any cost reduction, you're pulling one of those three levers. You don't have very many more levers than that to pull. So I think we'll continue to talk to the employees first, and we'll let you know our development on employee numbers on a quarterly basis as it evolves.
That's fairly reasonable. Okay, thank you, Katie.
Thanks very much, Fahid. Have a good day.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chris Manners of Barclays. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Katie. So just two topics, if I may. The first one was just on Ulster. I can see that, you know, the net interest margin is down 7 basis points quarter on quarter. I guess you've, you know, explained that because there's been a IFRS 9 accounting change for interest and suspense recoveries. Just trying to work out, is that 155 bips? Is that a good run rate for Ulster, and how we should think about that Ulster margin going forward? And sort of linked to that, when we look at the cost income ratio, it's in the 90s. What are you going to try and do with Ulster? Are you going to actually try and take some cost out there, or do you think you can try and grow into that cost base? Just a little bit of help there would be really useful. The second point was just on PPI, and I was looking at your sort of sensitivity table you put. If I understand that rightly, does that mean that you've, up till June 2019, you received 4.1 million total complaints, and then you received another additional 20% versus the total base of complaints received, or another 800 million in basically the first 2 months of Q3. I mean, that seems like an awfully big step-up rate. And then when I look at lower in the table, you've actually got, you know, the amount of no PPI seems to be, you know, roughly 30% for all your claims to date and in that last block. So is it fair to say that the complaints in the last block, 70% of them do have PPI, so the quality is not actually so much different of those complaints from the ones received before the deadline? Thanks.
Sure, thanks. Let me deal with the Ulster one first. In terms of NIM, I think, you know, NIM can move for many different kind of sort of reasons. And I think that, you know, where they are just now, it's not a kind of bad guide to the future. But one thing obviously to bear in mind is that the ECB rate cuts that came through in Q3 will obviously start to impact a little bit from Q4. So you might see a little bit of pressure still to come from that. I think that's important not to forget. In terms of the cost income ratio, it's not a question of growing into that cost base. You know, as we look at Ulster, we've talked about this a lot, is that when Jane joined, you know, what we said that she should do is to say, look, in your first year, let's focus on some of the regulatory and control issues, let's focus on your non-performing loans, and let's focus on some capital extraction. I think on the first and regulatory control, she's done a tremendous job. The non-performing loans, we've recently announced our second big drawdown of that, which will get us down to the kind of 5% level. And in terms of the dividend, you know, we continue to work on that. And then the focus for next year is really about, like, how do we right-size that kind of cost base? They've already started on that. You'll see some movements in some of their buildings, the changes in technology and things like that going on. So I would hope that it will be one of slow, steady and kind of continuous improvement. If I look at PPI, which is, you know, page 20 of the IMS, it's in terms of the volumes we received, yes, it really is as remarkable as you suggest in terms of what came in. I mean, it was truly unexpected for all of us. And I think it's one of the things that we have looked at time and time again is how could we not have realised there was such a volume coming towards us. I think it's something that was an absolute industry piece. So it really is as dramatic as you think. In terms of the no PPI rate, look, it's obviously these rates are a kind of, they're a blended rate of many claims which have got huge levels of no, of very little validity, and others that are more. What we see at the moment is we're kind of comfortable to hold that sort of rate of the 32% as we go forward. Early in the day, one of the journalists was asking me to say, look, you've seen this big step up from 28% to 32%. What I would say is that 32% has been much more in line with what we have done more recently and what we have seen with our customers. So it's kind of quite consistent in terms of where we are, which, you know, when we did our earlier estimate, we did certainly try to aim to make sure that we were consistent in our calculation of that range.
Got you. Because when I look at that means that you have 800,000 complaints, 70% or 68% of them do have PPI, which probably means there's actually quite a lot of people who've missed the deadline who would have had a valid claim. I'd assume that when you had that huge spike in claims rate, that the quality would be quite a lot lower than what you'd had in the sort of preceding, I guess, 8 years, and it actually doesn't seem to be too different. Is that a fair characterization?
So I think in terms of, I probably won't comment on people that did or that didn't claim and what their status is. Obviously, everybody had plenty of opportunity to do so, but I think at the moment, as I look at the provision we've got, we're kind of comfortable with where we're provided.
Understood. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Rayner of Numis. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Tom.
Good morning. Can I just come back to NatWest Markets, please? Just ask for a little bit more detail on the rates performance in the third quarter, because obviously it was quite a big hit, and I don't think this sort of hit was obvious in the US investment banking results we've had. So you mentioned sort of curve flattening in the text. I mean, can I assume that in August that you were positioned for steepening or some such or other explanation? Because just trying to get a sense for what is the risk that, you know, a similar sort of performance is, you know, is repeated sort of going forward. And also, was there any impact on sort of bonus accrual in the third quarter reflecting the very weak rates performance? Thank you.
Lovely. Thanks very much indeed. So I'm probably not going to comment on any bonus accrual impact at this stage, I would say, so I'll deal with that one quite quickly. Look, as I look to the NatWest Markets revenues, I think you've got to kind of cast your mind back a little bit. What did we decide to do with NatWest Markets? We took a decision that they would concentrate on euro and sterling rates. So that means that while you haven't seen this impact in the US banks, they also have very significant US exposures as well. And if I look at our US business, which is very small in comparison to the rest of the business, you know, we would see that it did perform better. But obviously, it's not of a size that it would be able to offset any of the issues within the euro business. What we saw was that the rates business saw an extremely fast and significant move in the long end of the euro rate curve. And the reality was that there were kind of one-way directional trades that were going on with widening kind of bid-offer spreads. And that's really what's coming into the numbers. But for me, the important thing of the fact that we're focused on sterling and euro and that there isn't that natural set-off that you get if you have a wider range of currencies, that's kind of, I think, why you see some of the differences with the other banks. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Cham Sol Yoon of UBS. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's actually Jason Napier. Thank you for
taking
my question.
Oh, Jason, that sounded more like you. Good morning, Jason.
How's it? Sorry. Two questions, please. The first, just on the outlook for net interest income. I wonder whether you might be able to unpack the sort of various headwinds around things like, evolution of the hedge. You've spoken several times about the front book, back book gap in mortgages, and then there's the consequences of debt that's been issued and retired. And I guess in summary, consensus basically has next year's NII at in line with the third quarter annualized. Is that, can you hold NII flat into next year might be the sort of summary question there. And then secondly, just coming back to NatWest Markets again, two things. The first is, this is a business that ex strategic costs and litigation is not making any money, either in the third quarter or year to date. And I just wonder what consequences that has for its cost of funding, its funding structure. It runs less capital than the group average at this stage, and I wonder whether there's any relevance there. And then secondly, its linkages with the rest of the group. Year to date, 16% of its core income was paid to other divisions. Is that a decent proxy for how dependent it is on the other divisions as far as customers are concerned? Do we just double that and say about a third of it is corporate and non-institutional? Does the institutional side actually make any money? Thank you.
Okay, lovely. Let me try to work through them. Jason, how lovely it is to get to question seven before anybody asks me about NIM. So thank you for that. Look, so if I look at, there's a number of different things going on in NIM. So let's kind of sort of talk through them. So if I think of the kind of the headwinds, you're all very well versed in the mortgage front book, back book story. So we, Q2, our back book was 158 basis points. It's now 155. We talk about writing in this corridor of 80 to 100 basis points. So writing slightly above that, and that's true for our kind of ongoing our ongoing applications. But the reality is it's a fall in the 2- and 5-year swap rate that is benefiting that margin. But it's good to see the income that's offsetting the margin fall, so that does kind of help. Now, front book margin is only one side of things. Obviously, within that 155 basis points we have for the whole group, there's higher things around the SVR, buy-to-let, and switchers, which we don't talk about those rates so much. In terms of structural hedge, what we see within there, it was rolling off at 101 at Q2. It's now moved to 100. You'd expect it to move quite slowly because it is obviously a long hedge, and so the purpose of it is very much to smooth the income stream. I think when we were at Q2, I was talking about that it was going back on about 47. Today it's going back on at around about 70 basis points, so there's been a bit of recovery. But, I think as well as I do, that's been a dance of kind of up and down in terms of that recovery piece. So we're still comfortable on that, but look, it's definitely a headwind, definitely a headwind. One of the things I think to give you guidance going forward still does remain kind of difficult. What do I think about is what's going on in the rate sensitivity, and I think the applications rate we're at really kind of demonstrates that. Where are we in terms of the level of liquidity we're holding? While we're a little bit lower in liquidity this quarter, it's not something that particularly impacts NIM, and we're not looking to lower that particularly fast in the coming months, and obviously the economic uncertainty. I think one thing to remember just in Q4, you'll be familiar that we normally take a behavioural life adjustment on the mortgage book in Q4, and that's something that will come through in our NIM number in Q4. I won't give you the exact numbers, but what I would tell you is behavioural lives are shortening, so people are staying on SVR for less time. Now, that's good. We're working very hard with them to make sure that they're staying on SVR for less time, because what we're doing is switching them into new longer-term products, and it's good to get them locked in at that rate. So you'll see a little bit of a dent in Q4 on that piece. But how all of these things come together, obviously, as ever, Jason, kind of leave it up to you to kind of see how they all kind of tie together. Then in NatWest Markets, look, I think your proxy on the income is fairly accurate. If you take what we distribute into other businesses, then actually you kind of double that. Half of it stays in NatWest Markets, half of it goes to the other businesses. I think that is a good kind of proxy. At this point, obviously it's a Q3 call. We're not making any kind of big conversations on NatWest Markets, and it would be foolish to react to one quarter and then kind of take it down. But look, we recognise, and we have talked many times about, even when we get to the targets, we have talked about this at those numbers is a business that delivers 6% ROE. Obviously, I think the confidence on the income's taken a bit of a dent in this last quarter. A bit 6% ROE is definitely below our cost of capital. They're finishing this stage of the work they've done. We obviously need to, and we'll update you more on what the next stage is as to how we continue to work to improve those ROEs that they're making. Thanks, Jason.
Yeah.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Jennifer Cook of Exane. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Jennifer.
Morning. A couple of questions, please. Firstly, I just want to ask a question on fee income. Not looking to preempt any actions you may announce at full-year results, but if you were to lose the income contribution of NatWest Markets, your revenues would be roughly 75% NII weighted. That would put you amongst the top end of your peers in Europe. And if there's one thing the last year has taught us, it's that being overly geared to the rate cycle is not necessarily the best idea. So I want to understand what options you had for growing fee income elsewhere, and also what your ideal NII to fees revenue mix would look like. Secondly, just on Ireland, following your portfolio sale a few weeks ago, back of the envelope suggests you're loosely on a 8% NPL ratio, so quite close to the 5% target. I want to understand if there are any implications we should be thinking about for 2020, as we've typically seen an impairment charge following the sale, and given that the loans won't come off your balance sheet until 2020, could this push you towards the higher end of your 185 to 190 billion guided RWA range for the year, and mean that the green light for Ulster excess capital repatriation won't occur until next year? Thanks.
Great. Jennifer, if I miss any of your points out as I go, don't feel embarrassed to kind of come back to me. Look, in terms of as I kind of look at fee income, I would agree with you. Nobody wants to be overly dependent on the rate cycle. And I think that's really why you see us doing such a lot of work at the moment in terms of some of our new initiatives around Till and Optimise and things like that, because those are fee income-based businesses. So I think it's how do you kind of manage that fee income piece and really try to kind of move the bank so that your fee income is a far more kind of sustainable number. And I think that's a challenge that we all have. I probably am not going to give you a range of we want this percentage or that percentage, but certainly non-interest income is a big focus for us. In terms of the NPL sale, look, on I obviously have the benefit of knowing more about the transaction. I think by the time we get to 2020, we'll be around that 5% number. Now, what's interesting in there is it kind of depends what cures in the interim, but obviously that helps you get to the 5% and how big things currently go out. Interestingly, I was interested by your comment to say that normally when the transaction finishes, you see a larger kind of impairment charge. I mean, we have definitely benefited from write-backs as we've taken these impairments off the book. There was a bit of a write-back this quarter, and that was the kind of the end of the previous transaction coming through. So, I mean, I think Ireland has benefited from a kind of a level of write-backs as the transactions kind of complete out. We'll wait to see, in terms of the second transaction, how it evolves, but you'll definitely see a little bit of I'm sure, fluidity around that number. I don't see them as a threat to our RWA guidance, particularly, you know, our RWA guidance is the 185 to 190 for this year. We're very comfortable with the 10.5 billion in terms of the mortgage floors. Obviously, that's the UK, not Ulster. And at the moment, our 5 to 10% guidance on BAL is kind of unchanged. But I'm not concerned particularly that Ulster would be someone that would be changing that guidance. You know, they're 5% of the RWAs at this stage anyway. It's not a significant part of the group. Hopefully I picked them all up, but if I didn't, let me know.
Yeah, no, that was useful. Thanks. No, it's just interesting because last portfolio sale you had from Ulster, I think you had around a 60 million impairment charge that came through subsequent to that related to that sale. So just interested to know if there could be anything like that we could see again, but it sounds like
yeah,
not.
Yeah, so look, Jennifer, I'll get Alexander to follow up with you offline because I mean, our view is more that we actually had some more write-backs from that sale, and I think it could well be timing of different things happening, but we could take you through the last kind of quarters on that. But when we do these sales, we try to make sure that we make the right kind of assumptions in terms of their value so that we don't have that. And, you know, my view is that we've had more write-backs rather than additional charges, but Alexander will give you a shout after the call and kind of dig into that with you a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joseph Dickerson of Jefferies. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi, Katie. You've answered most of my questions. I guess just on this project fear overlay or the uncertainty impairments that you've been taking, what would it take for those to reverse back out?
Yeah, so I mean, the best place I really think to kind of have a look at is almost in terms of, I think it's page 121 of the financial statements, where we give you the kind of the sensitivities. Now, clearly life has moved on since we did those sensitivities and we published them in February, and the economics are a bit different. But what you can see there is that this is the base case, what we had assumed around growth, what we just assumed around yield, and this is where then what's our downside two scenario. So while the, if I did downside two and I ran it today, it would be a different number because the book would be different, things have evolved. It's going to be in the round in terms of the quantum. So it's almost, you sort of need to think, well, if you've now put a kind of 50% probability on that downside two, you need to move back to base, and then you start to see them kind of revolve out. You know, your history and my own would say that it will never flow out as neatly as it flowed in terms of talking about 55 and up 101 sort of last year, but you will sort of see things go up. But I think for me, as I look at it, what do I need to believe externally is that you get a good Brexit, and consensus economics move improve, and then you'd see the mess kind of start to unwind at that stage. And I mean, that's kind of the bottom line. Thanks, Joe.
So it's somewhat beholden to then a consensus
economic,
basically then the weighting that you would apply to the different scenarios on top of that.
Yeah, and look, the weighting is definitely more art than science. So I think that what we look at is to say, what do we, where is consensus economics? I mean, we talk very much that we run things by consensus economics, and so that as you start to see that really improve, then you'll start to, you would see, you start to see it kind of reverse back out. And look, let's hope we all get to see those reversals. I would be as delighted as the rest of you. But we'll certainly talk about them as and when they happen.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Chris Cant of Autonomous. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks, operator. Operator, after this, I've got one question on the web, so I'll take that after Chris and then come back to the phone lines. Chris, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. Two, if I may, please. Your remarks at a recent conference pointed to $6.1 billion as a revenue run rate for the second half of this year. I presume, given the NatWest Markets print, that's now incorrect for the second half of 19. But do you view that as the right sort of run rate going into 2020? I think at the time you gave those remarks, the market was expecting rate cuts in the UK. Obviously, there's been a bit of a change in the interim. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that, please.
Yeah.
Follow up on PPI, point of detail on PPI as well. You've talked about complaint numbers. Obviously, one of the issues that all of the banks have faced with this in recent months has been information requests. I just wanted to understand how that fits into your disclosure, because I don't see any sensitivity around the assumptions on the conversion of information requests into complaints. So have all the information requests now been dealt with, and you've established that they're all customers, and therefore you've quantified the number, or are you still making an assumption on the conversion rate for information requests? And if so, what has been your experience? What is your assumption on the conversion between information requests into complaints, please? Thank you.
Sure. No, thanks so much. So let me deal with the rates piece. I mean, I think what I would say is, you know, we're in Q3, so the 6.1, the 6.100 probably feels a little bit toppy, I think, as you're right, with in terms of NatWest Market. So I would probably kind of pull myself back a little bit from that. Not dramatically, but I would certainly take it back a bit. As I look into 2020, look, we're working really hard to kind of sort of maintain sort of income levels. I think some of the things you need to be mindful of, and I know many of you are, is around the level of regulation that's coming through within UKPB in terms of things like the high cost of credit review, the EU payments agreements, the overdraft fee piece. That'll be a little bit of a headwind. And what we're planning that when we speak in February, I'll give you some more guidance about what kind of headwind that looks like as we continue to work through our regulation. But it will be a little bit of a headwind on that side of things. If I look to the complaint numbers, look, we've, in terms of information requests, we're 50% through that number. And then what we do is we've kind of built that into some of the conversion numbers. But we're very comfortable being so far through all of the information requests that we've actually got them pretty well nailed in terms of some of these assumptions. So we haven't given those stats to date, and I don't really feel that they're relevant for now, just given how far through we are all of those the conversion of those. And we've built it into the estimates there. So I think if you work with what we've got in the disclosure, you'll be in good shape.
If I could just push you a little bit on that last point, Katie. I mean, it's what we've seen from peers suggests that information conversion rates assumed are quite low, and it feels like that could be a sensitivity going forward. So in terms of the 50% done, obviously you've got quite a big sample size there and feel confident in your assumption, but just keen to understand what percentage you've been experiencing so we can think about the potential risk.
Chris, I mean, you're absolutely right. They're very low. I mean, I think in terms of our own percentage, they're really in single-digit percentages in terms of that conversion and very low single digits. If I can kind of guide you to the number, I'm just conscious we haven't given out in the past, but the 50%, there were significant numbers of these kind of queries. So the 50% is a huge number that we have gone through, which is why we have the level of confidence that we have.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Sorry, I'm not paying attention to my own instruction there. Forgive me. We've got a question on the web from Gary Greenwood at Shorecap. Gary, thanks for popping it on. Question one, how long are you willing to accept poor performance from NatWest Markets before you say enough is enough and seek an alternative strategy? What I probably say is I think we've probably talked about that quite a lot so far this morning, so I don't really have anything further that I would add on that. Please pop something up on the line if you disagree, Gary. But in terms of question two, you mentioned the new mortgage business is being written at margins above the 80 to 100 basis points range. Do you think the market is therefore becoming less competitive? So the way that I would look at that, I don't think it's becoming less competitive. I think the market is as competitive as it was. What we have seen, obviously, is people like Tesco's and Sainsbury's kind of pull out of the market. So those are strong signs that actually the competition has forced smaller players to re-kind of think their book. But if I think of things like pricing, I think what you'll see is a lot of activity where we and others will actually adjust particular points on the loan-to-value curve or particularly particular tenors, and we try to kind of seek the conversion piece there. I mean, I think the important thing that we and everybody else are really benefited from the lower swap rate curves, and, you know, in terms of it becoming less competitive, no, but I do feel that we've stabilised quite a lot over the last few quarters, and we're kind of sticking more or less in that kind of range, which is helpful, rather than it can be a continuing journey down. Hopefully that helped, Gary. Tracy, do you want to go back to the phones?
Thank you. Your next question comes from Ed Firth of KBW. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Ed. How are you doing?
Yeah, good morning. Very well, thanks. Just I want to ask about the restructuring costs, actually. I think you'd said $1.2 billion for this year. You're obviously well below the run rate for that now. So should we be assuming that that's going to come in well below that, firstly? And I guess secondly, I mean, all the mood music sounds to me like we're going to have a whole load more restructuring next year and beyond. Is that a fair assumption to make? And if it is, can I ask you to comment again on your $500 million normalised, what do you call it, litigation and restructuring costs? Because we've never seen that. We've never seen anything remotely close to that. So I'm just wondering how we should think about that going forward. And then I guess the final question, sorry, after all this time you must be exhausted, but the final question is, on the NatWest Markets, when you actually did the when you actually launched the whole program, you talked about moving back office to front office staff ratios from 4-1 to 1-2-1, and that was really a big part of the whole drive. I guess externally it's not really clear at all that we've seen that or how well you're doing with that. So could you just tell us where are we in that? I mean, what is the ratio today and how confident are you still that you're going to get down to that sort of, I think you said 1-2-1, something like that, back office, front office.
Okay, so let me take them starting from the top. So in terms of restructuring costs, we talked about, 1.2 to 1.5. We'll feel we'll be a bit closer to the 1.2. What I often find is there's often a lot of activity happens in Q4. So I wouldn't bring that number down just yet, and if we're a little bit above or a little bit under, I would kind of stick with the 1.2 at this stage.
Just to be clear, that's like a $400 million restructuring charge in Q4.
It's possible. It's possible, I would say, at the moment. So I wouldn't make a big difference on that. I would say stick with that number, and we'll be in the round, I would think, on that sort of space. In terms of restructuring into next year and beyond, look, the 500 million is certainly the best kind of guidance that I've got for you. Of course, you're absolutely right, we've not seen that, but you would not have expected us to see that given the last few years of history with things like the DOJ and the PPI. But as I look at it, the 200 million a year of kind of guidance on conduct doesn't feel inappropriate, which is sort of two-thirds of that number. And I think, you know, in terms of what our priorities are in February and as we move forward, we'll talk more about that when Alison and I chat to you more in February. So I think, and if that guidance needs to be revised, we'll give you that guidance.
But just to be clear, though, I mean, things like restructuring NatWest Markets would not be within a 300 million charge, would it? Or would it? I suppose that's my question.
Yeah, so look, I think it all depends what you choose to do. You know, I think one of the things I talk a lot about restructuring, you can only exit buildings once, you know, and that's,
yeah,
you know, that's,
no, that's true.
You know, 500 million over the charge today. I can't leave Bishop 280 Bishop's Gates twice, sort of thing, and close down other buildings. So there's some things that you know you can't do again. You know, if you decided to do something that was significant, then you would obviously have other kind of costs about it. But really, I mean, say more at this time, Ed, I'd be kind of pulling numbers out of the air that don't really have the right basis on. So I think ask for patience to February, I'd be really, really grateful for that. In terms of NatWest Markets and the staff ratio, look, I'm sorry, what I would say is I don't have the number to hand at the moment, but I think it would be fair to say we are still working towards that basis. You know, and that's part of the work that business is still continuing to do. I don't think we're yet at the end of that journey, but I can't give you a better number at the moment, sorry.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Ed. Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Andrew Coombs of Citi. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, Andrew.
Good morning. If I could have one follow-up on costs and then one on dividends. On the costs, you talked about the property exits. I think they were mainly at the end of the quarter, so presumably that's the main driver of the extra 107 million savings you're looking for in Q4. And is there any reason not to extrapolate or annualize that going into 2020? Secondly, on the dividends, page 13, you have 362 million accrued for foreseeable ordinary dividends. I just wanted to check what exactly is inclusive within that. Presumably that is the ordinary dividend. Is there any 81 in there? And presumably there's no accrual for a special. That is a Q4 decision alone. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. So in terms of property, in terms of the guidance, so we have spent this year about 500 million in terms of property costs and exits. And if I think it's the run rate of that in terms of savings going into 2020 and beyond, you'd see, I want to say, about 70 to 80 million number kind of saving that will result from that, and building on obviously what we've done in the early years. So that's probably a good thing to kind of look at. In terms of dividend, I'd say well done. That's good eyes and good maths that you've done this morning. Look, you know that one of the things that we need to do in terms of the regulations is that we take a percentage of our profits in terms of what we see as our ordinary dividend policy. So in fact, at H1, we actually took 5p off in terms of 40% of those results, and then we declared a 2p dividend at that point. So I wouldn't, it certainly only relates to ordinary. You're not required to do anything on specials until the board has actually made the decision. I wouldn't take it necessarily as the guide of exactly what we're paying out at the end of the year. We've got a dividend payment policy of, you know, around 40% of our profits, and it's a conversation that we'll start to have with the board in December. But I mean, you're absolutely right in terms of that number.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Operator, I've got one more on the telephone, on the web, which I'll just take if that's okay. So from Thomas Sanderson at HSBC, Brexit. Have any considerations been made to prepare for Brexit from a retail perspective? Potential customer impacts if any downturns occur? You know, I mean, certainly we've had a huge amount of work going on both in retail and commercial. It's obviously commercial that's more impacted. Obviously, the retail is impacted in as much as if there was a whole market downturn and you started to see things like unemployment increase, and what impacts that might that have on some of our unsecured lending. So that's something that we very much stress for as we look for that. We've also done quite a lot of work with customers who operate across border life. So they might well live in Spain, but they operate here, how do we service them? And we've done a lot of work in terms of with other regulators to see what servicing we can continue to do with them, or if they actually need to move some of their banking relationships more to kind of local countries. That's not a huge portion of our base, But I guess for those customers that it does impact them, it's an important point for them. So we've been having kind of conversations and guidance on that space. So hopefully, Thomas, that answers your question. Tracy, is there anything else on the line?
No further questions coming through on the line.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Tracy. So if I just thank you all very much for joining the call today. You know, I am confident that we're delivering on the levers that we need to do to take this business forward. And Alison and I look forward to updating you all in February. And with that, we'll sign off. Thanks very much for your time.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.